Session number 19922, Reel 4.
Smith, Reel 4.
Yes, to continue. We were making our way along, and the next thing I knew was that my colleague, with his equipment, just disappeared from sight. Not that I could see much. We were sort of stumbled along in the gloom, and I thought, what the hell has happened here? Next thing I knew, that I was also following him down this deep hole, a leaded boots first on his head. Well, obviously, the next thing was, there was one or two swear words coming out, and I said, quiet, keep your voice down, for God's sake. And in doing so, we dropped our field telephone. Now, the field telephones of that time were more or less the ones they used in the last war. Quite heavy and bulky, really. And they got quite a good bell in them. And as it hit the ground, it made quite a loud ringing noise. Anyway, it wasn't very long before the next thing we knew was that machine gun fire directed from our flanking companies, that is, it must have been brain guns, there's unmistakable sound of 303 fired at 303 ammunition fired at by a machine gun. And we just had to get our heads down. And you could hear the rounds riffling through the paddy fields, the wet paddy fields. And I thought to myself, God almighty, we've started something here. I don't know if we're going to get out of this. This guy has to abort this somehow, get back, and not repair a line. There must have been some fault in communication with the flanking companies. Sounds bad talking about the British Army as having a fault in communication, but things happen like that. And they were unaware that two signalers were working out in the no man's land, the mine gap, to the listening patrol, repairing lines, unaware of this fact. So the mandate in those days was that if there was unknown movement in the minefields, other than the standing patrols, which their positions are well known by all the companies, their map references, they would open up. And we were duly pinned down. Eventually the fire stopped after it seemed ages, and thought ourselves very lucky. And the company had been told, obviously, that to cease because we were working out there. Anyway, we quickly repaired the line, and from then on we got back out of there as very, very quickly. Now, on other occasions, we were out there repairing lines, and about halfway out, and there was, you could hear, muffled, as it were, Chinese voices. And it was well known that Chinese would even come into minefields, even lift the line, the mines, leave them laying on the top, work their way out through the minefields, exploratory patrols. They're very courageous in doing this. The Chinese are quite feared night fighters. They have no sense of... their sense of death is completely different from ours, I believe. They were coming... we were out on this occasion, and my colleague nudged me and he said, Chinese, you know, quietly like that. So we, as they approached, we were actually repairing lines. And as we approached, I do believe we'd actually finished our job. Our mandate, of course, from our officers was instructions was to go out, obviously heavily armed for protection, but our mandate was not to go out and take on the enemy or to start a mini-war, firefights on their own. is merely to protect us in doing our job. And our job was to go out, fix lines, make sure they're working 100%, and then come back. Mission accomplished, as it were. If we ran into anything, well, we just had to get on with it. On this occasion, they were very, very close. You could, I suppose, dimly make out movement in the distance. And all we could do was throw a grenade and let them have a few rounds, Sten guns down the gap, burst, a few bursts, and then we got the hell out of it. We tore back down, stumbling down the, in the night, down the track between the tapes that would be run down to mark the mine gap, and stumbling through the barbed wire in our four positions. As we approached our position, we called out to the four guards. We called out to the guards in the four positions, Chinese, and eventually got into the main control bunker. One particular big operation out there, known as the Battle of Pimlico, or Operation Pimlico, this is well documented. The battle sequence and the radio messages, including my own, are all down on paper in the archives of the National Army Museum, and more important, I suppose, in the archives of the Royal Fusiliers Association. But I won't go through the sequence of events on Pimlico because it would take too long. As I say, it's well known and well documented. But in fact, there was two Pimlicos. They had a raiding party, which I went out on. Signallers, headquarter company signallers attached to companies at that time, you controlled the radios at the command post working with the officers and the forward spotters of the, it was then the New Zealand artillery. It was all on the same network. You would not normally go out on for raiding patrols unless they wanted a fully qualified senior signaller. So you go out with, say, a 31 set, which is quite heavy by today's standards. The sets we had in the bunkers were the 18 set, which is very similar to the ones they had in the tanks. This is quite a big affair. There's a full-blown transmitter. We would use various radios for the internet around the company. But the ones we carried on patrol were the 31 set, including all your other equipment. So it was quite weighty, and I'm only an average built fella, so must have been very fit. We went out on this particular patrol, raiding patrol, down through the mine gap, and immediately ran into Chinese patrols. Now, this particular raiding party was supposed to have been the one that was to go on to Chinese positions and with bunker grenades and various heavy explosive equipment, and also try and capture enemy personnel for interrogation. But this was aborted because we ran into trouble. And when they ran the back, we went back to our positions after this, cut a long story short. A few days later, about a week later, I think, the actual date escapes me, but it's down on paper somewhere. On the 24th, the night of the 24th, and the following day, the 25th, they re-ran the Operation Pimlico, and signallers, such as myself, we were told to our presence would not be to go out on patrols. We were to stay with the company and make sure the radio network was 100% solid, working 100%. Such as they didn't want the operation to go wrong again in any way, so all eventualities were covered, including especially communications. When the actual, I can remember on the night, the actual company's patrols going out through our, checking with us as they, through our headquarter company bunker, going out on the particular raid. And as it is read, unfortunately, this raid ultimately went wrong because the Chinese got wind of it again. George Hawkinson, who was then a platoon signaller, company signaller, is on a different set to myself, the more portable sets. He was pinned down on this particular position, and many men had been lost, wounded or killed, and frantic messages were going out through myself and my officers working with me on the set to try and consolidate their position. It was then decided by George Hawkinson, with it's through communication with our officers, that they would shell his position. Messages were passed to the artillery officer of the 16th New Zealand Regiment, as it was then, to put a ring of fire down round the actual hill itself. In other words, encircling him with a ring of fire to try and move the Chinese off, because they were being overrun. In fact, eventually they were overrun. I might say, I suppose I was, myself and my colleague were instrumental in this particular action. And I won't go through the entire action because, as I say, it's all written down. But when the, many years later, I was at the Tower of London and George Hawkinson walked in, no one was more pleased to see him than myself, because when his set, radio set, eventually went dead and he was overrun and captured by the Chinese, it was, without sounding silly or exaggeration, for a signaller to lose contact with a person that's in trouble, as a signaller's job, we take it very seriously. It was almost as though you'd failed in your duty. The fact that you couldn't have kept the line open and got help to him, or got him to organise to get him out, as it were. So when he was at the Tower, went up and shook his hand. Now, I didn't know George as a close friend. I knew him, obviously, as a company man, but I didn't, he wasn't one of my closest mates, as it were, because he was from a different company. But I was so glad to see him, the fact that he was still alive, fit and well. He had, in fact, been captured by the Chinese and eventually repatriated after the war was over. The exact details of that are not in my possession, but he would be able to tell you himself if you ever interview him. And it's a strange feeling, really. It's ever since then, when I came out of the British Army, I went back to my old job with Hampton & Sons, the estate agents. My job was there, but the possibilities for the future weren't all that brilliant. As I said, I've been away for over 2 years from actual commercial life, and eventually I finished up. But as I was very fit, my father suggested that, as I couldn't settle down, I was having a hell of a job settling down when I came out. I used to get very depressed, And I know it sounds silly, I sometimes sit at the bottom of the stairs and cry my eyes out for no apparent reason. This sounds very, very stupid for a grown man to talk about this.
Was this because of Korea?
Yes, it's like an anticlimax. You'd been come from one situation to the other. I had, in fact, a form of shell shock, so that was confirmed to me later, but not serious shell shock, but it was a form of shell shock in that sense. A shock to the system, you might say, of all that had gone on. Anyway, I was still basically very fit and well. I suggested by my father that I be better if I went back into a service. With hindsight, when I look back on it, I would have it been better if I'd stayed in the army or a service, because I would have made a very good career of it. I think I was the right material. The reasons that I'll digress now, that I came, took DMOB at that time from the tower in 1953, was that my father remarried and taken a pub in the country, and as a child, had been away from home for most of my 21 years, I felt this is now I'm going to have a home in that sense where I can have a real family. My father remarried and taken this pub in the country, a free house, very much mine host, and a very nice dining room and what have you there. At any rate, I didn't take to going into the public house business, and eventually I applied and was accepted by the Hertfordshire Fire Brigade. To digress again, this is a thing that I went into. I found that being a signaller, being in communication, communications are very important in the army, in that it's their lifeline. I don't exaggerate my job or my position. It's very important over any other jobs that were done in the British Army, but it's a job that was taken very seriously, and the officers, of course, would expect you to be right on the ball in that sense, because you were their right arm, communication to their various sections, etc., especially in when you get a battle situation or any other wartime situation. To save, it's always been in my mind, a personal thing this, but it's the fact that George Hodgson came back. To me it was a great feeling, because as I say, I'm now speaking as an ex-fireman as well, to save a person's life is something that I think is probably the finest thing that anyone can do. It's a great thing to be in a position where you're able to save life. And this goes not only in wartime, but in peacetime. That is, the fire brigade is ultimately about the saving of life. I'm going back now. Sorry for my digression. But it's all to do with my feelings about being a radio operator. Operation Pimlico, or the Battle of Pimlico, was quite a serious affair, in that I've got the actual figures with me, but they're in the archives. There were quite a few members killed and wounded, and I can remember them coming back into the bunker, reporting what had gone on, and it was not a very pleasant experience at that time, because, as I say, a signaller, the lines, as I explained, if the sets go dead, they've been lost. You feel that you've not completed, you may feel you've not completed your duty, although you may have done it 100%, because they've been lost and you couldn't do anything to help them on this occasion. On the next day, over the next 48 hours, the next days, the officers mentioned to us that they're likely to be Chinese retaliation. Any raids that were had, they Chinese would then start shelling us and vice versa in retaliation. There was just the normal staffing fire that went on, but on this particular occasion, over this over the Battle of Pimlico and the days afterwards, especially the 48 hours and on, immediately afterwards, we had quite heavy shell fire. In fact, in and around this time, we were hit very heavily by Chinese artillery, not only mortars, but shelling. My bunker, which we lived just down a trench from the main bunker, which I shared with my colleague, as I say, it was only two of us normally, sometimes three if you're lucky. The third person would also be the company runner. He would double up and getting messages on foot to various sections. My bunker, we used to have, I'm getting away from the Battle of Pimlico now, but this is all to do with it. We would have beds made up by banging angle irons into the wall. These bunkers, incidentally, the command bunker was had logs and girders over the top, and top of it, on just the one side of it, was dug in was a Centurion tank. These Centurion tanks would attract more fire than they used to give out, they used to say. But they were on the hill and used to great effect. But the Chinese could see them and or knew their positions and would shell them, obviously. So if we were to fire off a few rounds, the next thing you know was that sooner or later you're going to get a load back. Mortars, shell, whatever. But at any rate, I was asleep in my bunker and I got out to do my next stint on the radio. And the heavy shelling that was happening at that time. And the when I went back to my bunker, which is quite deep below ground, I might add. I mean, the command bunker was 20 to 30 feet down. Our bunkers were a good 10, 15 feet down in the ground, off the driven into the walls, off the main trenches, which in themselves were. It's very reminiscent of the 1418 war, so I've been told by learned people. And my bed was covered in earth, and I wonder what had gone on. And through one wall there was a hole where my head would have been, and out the other end was the other hole. So if I'd been asleep, no one would know what would have happened. The shell passed through one side of the bunker and out the other. Fortunately, as I say, because of the emergency going on, I spent more time on the radio and standing to and repairing lines than I did sleeping. Hence, I was telling you about the lack of sleep. I think we went about 3 days where I don't recall sleeping at all. It was just constant work. You were required on the set or what have you. I suppose you must have slept. It must have been you'd have a sleep up against a wall for a few moments and that was that. You daren't sleep while you're on duty on a radio set. This was a court-martial offence. If you happened to doze off, which is very easy, we would smoke. We had free cigarettes, American and otherwise. And we would smoke almost consistently, as I say, one after another, to stay awake on the set. This is allowed. You couldn't smoke out in the open because it would be seen at night. If you did, you were taking a risk. So below ground, it was okay. At any rate, the shelling was quite heavy. About this time, early as the dawn came up on one particular day just after, I remember while I was out doing my duties, laying lines, and also we had to redig the trenches. Now, this is very hard work because the ground in the winter, or November, it gets very hard, and it's almost impossible to dig you can dig out what's been filled in, but to make them deeper, it's like digging concrete. Anyway, it had to be done, and we just had to clear the trenches. This was, normal work, which is on top of what you would do with signals, and repair the lines and what have you, make sure everything's running right. We also did our stints on listening on the radio, passing messages, radio checks, and what have you. And I was out one morning, the early hours of the morning, the dawn had just come up, and I think the sight of my colleagues, as you might say, from my regiment, all these stretchers laying on the backside of the hill, out of range or out of sight of the enemy. All you could see was about 20 of them, I suppose. There's quite a few, as I remember. You could see was the boots, and just covered with blankets. They were those that had been brought back from Operation Pimlico that had been killed. The Sergeant Major, who was always rushing around the trenches, as you know, Sergeant Majors, he spotted us, just something like gloating, or just stopped and looked at those that had been brought back. And in no uncertain terms, he told us to don't gloat and get about your business, signaller, or what have you. And of course, we did. But I can remember that particular occasion very well. A very made a big impression upon me. When you come to think that the times we used to go out on patrol ourselves when we were required, or when we went on line laying operations, that you could have been one of those. And I've often thought that I was doubly blessed. I was one of the lucky ones. This was mentioned to me at the Tower of London on one of our reunions not so many years ago. My Colonel Guy, as he is now, he was my commanding officer then, A Company it was, he said to me, it's nice to see you fit and well, Barry. And I said, well, I play tennis and go cycling and what have you. And I said, it's always been common in our family, sport mad. And he said, well, you're looking very well for your age. He said, you're lucky to be here. You're lucky to be here. And I, being a bit hard of hearing, having a hearing aid, because I've now got an army pension for my ears because of shell blast. But getting away from that, I'm a bit hard of hearing. And I said, what, lucky to be at this meeting, sir? And he said, no, lucky to be here at all. He said, because I can tell you this, he said, myself and my fellow officers on a number of occasions were very surprised to see you walk back in the bunker again.
Yeah. What did you mean by, after what?
Well, I'd been out on the patrol, and and the gravity of the situation was this: they thought, well, we've lost two signals. So it's quite a sobering thing. I don't wish to exaggerate this, because this is...